Mushroom Soccer here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Everyone, welcome to Soccer and my year in review discussion episode, kicking off the month of realignment coverage, where we're just going to do this final big discussion episode of the year, going through the themes that we've covered. Let's start with something very obvious. Sagar, I would love to get your thoughts on the China COVID protests that are developing, emerging. We don't really have any sense of what's going on right now. I did this really interesting episode with Frank DeCutter. He wrote the People's Trilogy on Mao. He's based in Hong Kong, and he pointed out that this is the first time since really the 1950s that there basically is just near zero Western, even foreign press coverage in China right now. So we don't really know what's happening. So with that said, like, let's get your theory on this.
I'm glad that that's actually my only takeaway. I have no idea. It's one of those, it's so difficult because all that's coming out to us is urban areas, Xinjiang, Urumqi, Shanghai, Beijing. What's going on in the village? No clue. It's one of those things where I could see it both ways. I could see the villagers being totally bought in because they have no access to the Western press. They're heavily censored. Chinese social media, and they could just be going along with it. I've seen some theories, though, that some of the biggest dissent could be coming from there. And my favorite theory is that by watching the World Cup, the Chinese population realized that the entire world no longer is wearing masks and is gathering in large places and not living in global lockdown. That said, it sounds a little too cute to believe. So I think we should just analyze it on what do we know? We know that there are protests in urban areas. And actually, then maybe that's all we need, because the CCP are genuinely so paranoid, and especially whenever the West is watching, that they will treat it as an existential threat, whether it is or not. That happened in Hong Kong. That happened in Tiananmen. Xi, I've read a lot about Xi and his impressions of Tiananmen. He and his family suffered a lot during the Cultural Revolution, and he in particular looks at universities as like hotbeds of, quote, chaos. And like anytime he sees students protesting, complete freak out. So unfortunately, I predict there will be a violent crackdown, and we will see. I mean, you're already seeing it, like the police, the way that the security state there. It is so dystopian. It's difficult to believe. I posted stuff on my Instagram of like police drones flying around apartment buildings being like, stay in your homes or we will arrest you. There's a decent thread. Let me find this, which is really good, from a Washington Post reporter who's actually in Beijing, which talks about how extensive and how much of a dragnet the surveillance state in China is. It's like, oh, you think you can wear a mask to go to a protest? No. Their facial recognition software is so good that they have 90 days worth of storage. And based literally upon the shape of your eyes, it's good enough that they, in court and in criminal proceedings, they have identified you. Even if you wear sunglasses and a mask, they could still find you. Quote, I've seen thousands of procurements describing Chinese surveillance systems over the years that are able to recognize despite face coverings and whether you have a, quote, yellow, white, black, or brown race face. In their parlance. Anyway, zero COVID. This is why I don't think zero COVID has anything to do with COVID. I mean, I think Xi and the current CCP is freaking out because GDP is going down and they have historic inflation. The first time, really, that GDP is not skyrocketing since 1976. I just have no idea. That's a violation of the social contract they made with the Chinese people, especially in the Deng Xiaoping era. And they're just going to do what they do best, which is control. So I don't think it has anything to do with COVID. I think it has to do with a natural expansion of the surveillance state compared with 21st century technology. What do you think?
Yeah, that's all good. I do actually think, though, to a certain degree, zero COVID has to do with COVID, quote unquote, at a kind of grander, almost narrative level. Mm. You know, when you, in your personal life, in your professional life, you get obsessed with this metric that in one specific context really matters, then you take it too far and it just ends up harming you. Mm-hmm. So I got into this during the Ukraine Daily series back in February. I was like, oh shit, Marshall, you're doing like these daily episodes, and like your ability to do a daily episode on this pressing issue is what distinguishes you as a podcaster, and you keep going. and you keep going. And I eventually had to just wake myself up and say, dude, stop doing daily episodes. The quality's really degrading. And Ruru is stretching from the Ukraine theme. Mm-hmm. Similar thing happened at a much grander, more important level with China and zero COVID. 2020. China, not just because the CCP is an authoritarian one party ruling, you know, organ of government, but actually because like the, you know, East Asians in general have been much more aggressive towards pandemics in general. SARS, bird flu, things during the 2000s and 1990s and even the 2010s, they clamped down much harder than the West did, and they suffered fewer deaths. And if we remember that early September, late August, October period of 2020, before the vaccines come out, before Operation Warp Speed is successful, when people still think that Trump, let's just say, like, stupid statements around, like, the country being back and good to go on April 15, mm-hmm. people thought that had to do with his actual vaccine development response. So but when they had nothing to do with each other, Trump making silly statements actually had nothing to do with the fact that Operation Warp Speed was actually succeeding, and they were going to actually hit their timelines. But back to the October 2020, at that point, everyone's hailing China, saying, look at China. Yeah. They kept their deaths down. They aren't having people, you know, in state houses doing these like protests and threatening people over lockdowns. Sorry, I remember it. You remember when you had a tweet, because this was amazing. You had a tweet in late fall where there was a concert, a big concert in China. Mm-hmm. And you were just like, man, like, I hate to just like say, go China, but man, I wish we can do this.
Actually, that was in Wuhan.
It looked incredibly fun.
Yeah.
So I think the CCP got addicted to that feeling of success and the metric of we do everything we absolutely can to quote unquote keep things open and reduce deaths to the absolute, absolute minimum. And obviously, like, the death numbers are almost certainly not accurate, as most statistics that come from the CCP are. But at least publicly facing, they're claiming that in contrast to the West, just total zero, near zero, but just like an incredibly small number of deaths relative to the millions in the United States. So I think it's obviously about bigger things than just COVID, to your point. But I think it's also just that the CCP has become addicted to the need to maintain this achievement. And because it's a non-democratic system, there are no checking forces. Like there is no force in Chinese society. They could say, hey, you've gone too far. You need to check that.
I think this is where I just don't know, because it's been a year of Omicron. Guys, it's November 30th. Remember last year when we were all freaking out about it? I remember everyone in New York was getting COVID and we were like, oh, actually the vaccine doesn't prevent people getting COVID. And you're like, okay, well, that kind of changed the whole narrative. They stuck to it for an entire year. And like, we've had a year of circulating extraordinarily infectious levels of COVID. So yeah, I mean, I think what you're saying makes sense, you know, 3 months in, but a year in, like, and especially after what happened in Shanghai. Shanghai was a nightmare. Do you remember
what happened in Shanghai?
Oh my God. They had like 40, 50 days of straight lockdown. Their citizens couldn't even order groceries on their phone. It was so a lot of in China, a lot of them order fresh vegetables online. I'm actually kind of familiar with this because it's the way it works in India. Nobody really like goes to the grocery store once a week. It's a market-based system in which you like get out of your house, you like turn around the corner and you go and you buy fresh vegetables at like the side place. It's more of like a daily environment. It's honestly healthier for you. Anyway, what happened in India is that because it's a democratic country. So instead of like all of that, what happened is that my grandfather was telling me this, which is with the rise of the internet, now everybody has mobile phones. You can just WhatsApp the storekeeper, and they actually come to your door with your vegetables, and then you just basically Venmo them with the Indian-based national system. So in China, pretty similar, actually. But people were unable to get food. Like, I'm not saying people were starving, but like people were down to the almost nothing. There's also no frozen food culture in China. So zero COVID is wreaking havoc at the most basic level of people's lives there. And that was several months ago. So for them to stick to it, it just seems deeply, deeply beyond something. I think you might be right again. And also, I want to take an opportunity to say this, which is, I think, and since this is year in review, something I've been thinking a lot about is the Richard Hanania piece, which is like, actually the end of history was correct. Like, actually 2022.
Yeah, this is the next topic. So we'll transition. Yeah.
2022 was a great test case for the alternative system to Western liberal democracy. Russia had a chance to show us that its military might, its authoritarianism, and differential system to the West could stand up on, based on a petro economy, commit military conquest in Ukraine, and then stand tall in its own country. Clearly, that has just not happened. Like, this is the thing. Even if they win, and they win a quarter of Ukraine, was it worth? Like, obviously, it was not worth it. Is destroyed part of their economy. Their elite is in turmoil.
Finland and Sweden are in NATO. There's more
a disaster,
NATO expansion
right?
About to
before. I remember saying that the day after the invasion. I was like, you know, you just fulfilled your worst dream. I was like, NATO was weaker than ever in 2019. It's like now you basically excel. Like, even though I think the Germans and the French are useless and don't spend enough money, they still are spending more than they were. They're, I guess, less useless today than they were in 2019. Anyway, the point is that, so put Russia there. So like the Russia was one example, kind of like in a Cold War type system. Well, China was a similar one. You know, China had the zero COVID dream, and then Omicron basically made that, Omicron basically nuked that. And over the last year, they've clung to it. Their economy and their inflation in China, again, there's no way to know. Nobody has any idea. But from what I have read, they have rolling blackouts. They have coal problems. They have a major test of CCP, like basic governance, and they keep reaching for the boot. And clearly, it's not working. And people shouldn't say, people shouldn't take this as me saying, oh, like the Putin regime is going to fall, the Xi regime is going to fall. I don't believe that for a second. What I'm telling you, though, is that clearly they're hanging on, and that's not thriving. Whereas, and look, I'm not going to say we're thriving, but if you look at the global West, like clearly there's just a hell of a lot more resiliency built into the system.
The funny thing here, because this is the, you know, end of history conversation, Francis Fukuyama came on the show back in May 2022 to talk about his new book. Y'all should check out that episode if you haven't seen it. But the reason why everyone's just going around with this, like, hey, maybe this end of history argument is correct, is Fukuyama, you know, famously has this essay in 1989 that it's expanded into a book after the Cold War, and where it's basically arguing, he doesn't argue it, you know, the basic explanation is that he doesn't say that, like, literally events don't happen. He doesn't say that everything's going to be peaceful and chill. That's kind of like a misstating. His point is just basically history as defined by, like, autocracy versus democracy, fascism versus communism versus democratic capitalism versus the mixed economy is over, quote unquote, in the sense that, hey, like, it may actually just turn out that liberal democratic capitalism, plus or minus on the capitalism side, because obviously, you know, Denmark and France and the United States and Great Britain are all capitalist countries that have varying degrees of socialism within them, is just probably, under his viewpoint, going to be the most effective system of organizing a human society in comparison to its competitors. It's not the 1930s where there's an actual debate of, hey, wow, you know, maybe fascism is a better system of government. Maybe communism is a better system of government. And, you know, in 2022, to your point, Sagar, this was the year to prove it. And then there's also another concept that I really think was just completely wrecked this year, which is this idea of the multipolar world. So you've had folks for a long time as response to the disasters of the Bush years. So, like, let's talk about the disaster of the Bush years. Post 9/11, it's the unipolar moment. You have people like Max Boot pretty much, like, calling for America to be an almost explicit, like, liberal empire. This is the American hegemony era, and this is just going to be better. Who cares about the UN? Who cares about multilateral institutions? Like, we're in the Pax Americana, and it's going to be glorious. The war in Iraq is the definition of a repudiation of all of those ideals, and it's a disastrous decision that obviously the U.S. is going to be accountable for the rest of your and my lifetimes. But that disaster caused a bunch of people to say that we need some alternate model for organizing the world. No one has any faith in the UN anymore as a, like, post-World War II institution. But they then say, instead of, like, this UN restraining the power of the United States, you get this multipolar world where India, China, Russia, South Africa, Brazil, like the BRICS from the 2002 Goldman Sachs report, where these countries are going to actually have a world that's not centered purely on the United States, but it's going to be centered around everyone basically competing and working together and checking each other, and that will be much more stable. What 2022 revealed is that a multipolar world, a world where the United States has less quote-unquote hegemony, if we think of hegemony as being this, you know, total amount of ability to do whatever it wants and impose its will, is a world where Russia invades Ukraine and then basically ruins the continent of Europe for the next several decades. Mm-hmm. And China takes Hong Kong. China threatens the world peace with its provocations towards Taiwan. And then it exports a model of authoritarian domestic fascism with the technology that you're referring to and those specific bits. So I think it's just so interesting that we've circled around to just this most basic conclusion that, hey, like, it turns out that giving a bunch of power to like an elderly one party ruler in the case of Xi Jinping is just not a good idea. Hey, it turns out that Vladimir Putin being an old guy who's obsessed with the 1980s glory days is also not a good idea either. These are obvious takes, but I think during the down points, that's difficult. There's an episode with Noah Smith that's coming out tomorrow, and I'd love to talk through a couple of the themes here. Basically, his conception is that he really describes the post-financial crisis era, so 2009, Barack Obama's presidency, to basically this past month with the crypto and tech crash. And everything we just discussed for 2022 is just like the long 2010s. Mm-hmm. In the same way that people like talk about how the 60s didn't literally end on January 1st, 1970. They basically went on through 1973, 1974 with Watergate. And then the 70s began. That's the term, the long 60s. So he's talking about the long 2010s. And he really describes the 2010s as this period of upheaval, anger, disruption. I would love to hear, because folks will hear Noah's answer to this question tomorrow. So I'd love to hear, like, what did you learn from this 2010s period of upheaval? Well, actually, no, let me rephrase. Do you think the 2010s just ended? Do you agree with that, yes or no? And B, what did you learn from this period?
I don't know. I don't think it's ended yet. I'll say, you know why? Because I think Trump is the last factor.
He's the final boss.
Yeah, he is. I think he's
right,
the final
that's
boss
a good point.
In the 2010s. Yeah. Trump. I mean, if you think about it, if you use the analogy, when did Donald Trump become a political figure? 2011, the rise of birtherism, all of that. And he announced for presidency in 2015, even though Joe Biden won. It's clearly not the Biden era. It's the Trump era. It's more about reaction to Donald Trump. So I'm not quite yet ready to say that it's over. I think it's possibly ending, although it could get a lease on life if Trump were to get reelected and back into office, which is certainly possible. So, yeah, I don't know. In terms of, look, I do think we are moving away from most of the assumptions, pop culture, most of the most basic conventional wisdom in 2011 is just like clearly not right. And I think that, so again, you know, it's funny. Did you watch that Jon Stewart interview with Hillary Clinton and Condi?
I didn't watch it. No,
it's just so cringe. It's one of those things where even if you believe, like, defending Libya, Iraq, all of that, you would just not say it in the way and in the terms that they use. And basically, no matter, like, again, even if you believe in the underlying policy, you would not defend it in the way that they did. Sheryl Sandberg, like, girl boss feminism, lean in feminism, so many just like icons of that time period are just not in any way like culturally relevant, are being turned against. Even the culture war, it almost seems like we're going back in time. Actually, today is a correct way to say that. Like, what are we talking about right now? The same things that you and I talked about in the 1990s, abortion and gay marriage. It's almost been like a reversion, despite, you know, all the gender identity and all those other fights. So I don't know. I'm not quite sure where I fall on that spectrum. But I do definitely think that something is ending and maybe something new is beginning. But I have no idea what that's going to look like.
Yeah, no, that's a... hard to make a quite prediction of what something new looks like. And I also, well taken, I agree with your point that you can't, much as, you know, the 1970s, that much as the 1960s don't end until Nixon's impeached at Watergate, if Trump loses in 2024, that would mark
that's the
end of the 2010s. Yeah. That's actually good. So yeah, I guess the 19, the 1962 to 1974 model would actually perfectly track. Because the point is, like, the 50s didn't really end until JFK is assassinated. This is like the mixed. Noah's point is that, you know, American history in terms of eras doesn't actually perfectly coincide with decades. We should treat decades as ideas rather than literal.
Yeah, I mean, the 90s ended in 2001 with the dot-com crash.
So September 11th. Yeah, right, exactly. That's exactly the right way to put it. So here's what I'm fascinated by. And you perfectly set this up with your point about Condi and Hillary Clinton. I'm fascinated by figures who don't understand that a specific moment is just over and haven't adjusted accordingly. So, like, let's talk about, like, Carrie Lake, defeated Republican gubernatorial candidate in Arizona. The day before the election, if I think when someone tries to, like, write this history of this moment, like when we get our Rick Perlstein era, like, explanation of, like, of this decade, and, you know, in our 20s, I think if you could really, like, cite the example of someone just taking it too far as Carrie Lake. So Carrie Lake, day before the election, she sees this, she does a presser with the media, and she's talking about she's going to make their lives hell. She's like, I'm going to make the next, like, 8 years just hell for you. And I was just watching it. And look, obviously, like, listeners, you, Sagar, like, you guys know my politics. Like, I'm obviously, like, not jiving with that. But I'm just, like, watching this, and I'm just sort of neutralizing myself, just trying to look at this as, like, an impartial observer. I'm just like, yeah, I still think this is it. But I don't think that the majority of Arizona voters in October, November 2022 are deeply invested in Carrie Lake's, like, personal beef with, like, the Arizona Republic's, like, media columnist, right? We're not even talking about Trump versus the New York Times. We're not even talking about, you know, Mark Andreessen versus Taylor Lorenz at the Washington Post. Like, we're just talking about Arizona state politics. And, like, by the way, like, who even reads, like, state newspapers anymore? So she's just saying, I'm going to make your lives hell. And it's sort of like, that just isn't it. I think that's the definition of someone bringing 2010s era discontent vibes to a period where most people are exhausted, in Noah's words. And
I think
just
that's
moving
easy
on.
To say, though, today. It wasn't easy to say that day. I think that day, what I would have said is, Marshall, I agree. I think it's cringe. That said, inflation, the way that the polls are trending, what I always looked at it is that the underlying structural strength of Republicans, or what should have been in the election, were giving cover to a whole lot of, like, batshit insanity. So I would have said, like, I agree. I think it's cringe, but I don't think it would have cost her anything. Now, obviously, that was wrong. And I think that that's important that it was wrong. So what can we...
I would say, to clarify, I still thought Carrie Lake was going to win. Like, you got me on the breaking point flash. Right. So my point wasn't that I saw that. I was like, oh, she's going to win. I saw that, though, and something just seemed off. That is kind of more what I'm talking about. And I guess I'm now able to post-op and say, well, now in retrospect, Carrie Lake. But look, we know this. Like, Carrie Lake had a terrible, like, ticket splitting. There were a bunch of Republican voters who, like, voted for, like, treasurer, but didn't vote for Carrie Lake. That's more what I'm talking about. Carrie Lake is a person who misjudged the mood of the electorate, specifically to, I think, your point with figures from this past era who are still making assumptions as if it's still 2016 all over again.
Yeah, you know, but that's why it's hard. How do you know? Like, something that's very humbling in doing this job is, like, I don't have any idea. I didn't think Trump was going to do as well he did, and he almost won the 2020 election. Then I thought that the Biden would get destroyed, and then he didn't in the midterms. Here's something I enjoy about politics is, like, people really surprise the hell out of you. And a lot of people actually pay very close attention. So, for example, I think you would agree that, so, like, Jan 6 rhetoric and all of that aside, there was an element to that discourse that Democrats were using, maybe not as much, but were using before the 2020 election, right? And people just didn't buy it. But then Jan 6 had to happen for people to be like, no, yeah, like, there's something
here. There's some bad
hombres. So, but I think that what's important about that is that people actually pay attention. So whenever you're just, like, shooting rhetoric at them, they don't care. They're like, okay, like, I'll make up my mind for themselves. It wasn't until they actually, like, not be on, stand Jan 6 apart. Like, look at Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania voters clearly were like, no, I'm not going to be at the center of some crazy stop and steal constitutional crisis, because they said that they're going to do it. They're like, I take you seriously. I believe you whenever you say that you would challenge the election results. So I'm just not going to do it. And, you know, I think there's actually something like deeply heartening with that. I think about it too with the 2020. So Dems genuinely thought, like, they knew defund the police and all that other stuff was very unpopular, but they're like, oh, but you know, Trump, like, people hate Trump so much that they'll look past it. I'm like, no, like, actually really almost lost you the entire election and basically gave you one of the most narrow House majorities up until this House majority. So, but then Republicans tried to make the defund the police thing about the 2022 election. And after Dems had effectively dropped that and done mea culpas, people didn't believe it anymore because they're like, no, see, now they say that they've learned their lesson and they actually took that seriously. So I see an electorate that does pay attention. And actually, I'm kind of heartened by that.
Like, that's good. It matters. Because if you did, like, you know this, like, it feels like sometimes it's all just
a repeat. Yeah.
But yeah, no,
it does matter.
That is heartening. That is.
I really believed. I believed in my. And maybe this is cynical. I was like, you know, $5 gas. Some people are just going to say, "Screw it, I'm going to vote for Doug Mastriano." But like, actually, you got to give people credit. A shitload of people voted in this election, and they didn't think that at all. And I was like, hey, that's nice. I like to see that.
Because the secret is, you elect Doug Mastriano, you're not getting any reduction in gas prices. You are getting,
yeah,
to but, your
I mean,
point.
People are capricious. Ooh, this is my thing.
I think you could know this. You could intuit, hey, you know, what's more likely? We elect Doug Mastriano. We repudiate the Democratic establishment of Pennsylvania. What's more likely? A constitutional crisis that's not the vibe of 2024, or all of our problems are solved?
Right, right.
I think people got most of that rebellious energy out. And this also is encouraging, too, to your point, Sagar, because we should say hopeful things. The clear takeaway, I think, if you're a political actor going into 2024 is, oh, wow, like, you actually have to show up.
Mm-hmm.
You actually can't just, because you know this, Sagar, obviously, and you've done, I love, like, talking about inflation with you, because you do a good job of, like, articulating, no, here is what you could actually do here. Here's the actual discourse on, you know, gas prices, oil, all that type of stuff. Republicans did not make a serious national campaign.
Yeah.
On reducing inflation beyond just the superficial and the obvious. And I hope a takeaway for Republicans, or basically anyone going into 24, is like, no, like, actually, people are paying attention. We have to be serious for our approach. We can't just default to, they're just going to throw us this layup, or way hardcore mixed metaphor. They're not just going to give us this layup or set up a T-ball hit for us,
yeah,
because we're not in power.
I agree with you. Yeah. I mean, I took that away too. I'm a little skeptical of some of the economic determinist arguments, but I do think it did matter on the margins. I mean, Fetterman, like, he outperformed Joe Biden outperformed Biden and outperformed Trump and Pat Toomey from 2016. So clearly, mm-hmm, like, something was going on. Was it Dr. Oz being bad? I don't know. I have no idea. Like, I'm just not going to try and take any granular takeaways, as what I found is that these are deeply complicated systems. That said, like, across the board, people clearly rejected MAGA-ish type candidates, although that doesn't really mean anything. Like, I honestly wouldn't yet have even put Dr. Oz in the MAGA category. Dr. Oz was not pro stop the steal. Dr. Oz was, like, pretty moderate on abortion from a right-wing perspective. Like, I mean, he's not Blake Masters, right? And he also lost at the same margin as Blake Masters. I'm like, okay, well, you know, deep something structural is going on. There was a lot of exit poll data that said that abortion was the top issue for Pennsylvania voters. So maybe it was structural to the entire GOP. But then Ron DeSantis wins by 20 points. So you're like, okay, well, hold on a second. So anyway, if I had to guess, I think abortion was probably the single most important issue in the election, much to the chagrin of many of the pro-lifers who don't want to hear that. I think secondary to that was stop the steal. And I think Ross said it well. I read it on our last show. I think there is a poly crisis for the GOP. And I see no structural grappling with all of that. So, like, Josh Hawley, for example, like, Hawley's like, we need an economic agenda for the GOP. And it's like, look, man, like, it's not 2018. Like, you can't say that every single year. Like, what does that mean? And on some level, I sympathize. You're only an individual center. You're only an individual. So I'm going to give credit where it's due. Marco Rubio right now is saying that he will. I've been really ginned up about this rail shit. It really makes me mad. These guys, like the way these rail companies.
Introduce the story. If folks
there's
are
a story. So, okay. So there was a prospective rail strike. There's something called the Railway Labor Act, which says that Congress has the ability to force a deal between railway unions and rail companies because it's of a strategic national importance to the U.S. economy and U.S. national security. The law was drafted in 1936. Okay. So the railway workers were trying to negotiate a new deal because they basically literally, and I'm not really not exaggerating, like do not get sick leave and they don't get days off. And they often work 30 days on straight with no ability. If they get sick, they don't get paid. If they have somebody in their family died, they don't get paid. It's just, it's horrific. You can't even believe it's real. These are not struggling companies. The companies themselves have made $150 billion in stock buybacks over the last decade, which is more than they've had in capital investment, all while shrinking their labor, which is part of why part of the issue here is that they are working so hard. Okay, so Joe Biden, there was a prospective strike that was coming down the pipeline. Joe Biden brought the rail companies and the railway workers to the table and came up with this deal, of which was then rejected by two of the major labor organizations representing workers, which set up the deal for a strike. Biden immediately came out and said, no, we're not going to do that. This would cripple the U.S. economy ahead of Christmas. We are going to force a deal by acting Congress under its authority from the Railway Labor Act to pass and force the previously negotiated deal. All right, so I'm setting all that up. But I just think it's wrong. Like, I really cannot fathom the government basically like forcing the conditions of your employment especially when your demands are so basic. And like on the railway, again, on the companies, like they clearly negotiate in bad faith because they know that they have a filibuster-proof majority of senators who are willing to back them. And in the House, they're basically Biden and the House of Representatives, Pelosi and others, are willing to just go along. And I just think it's fundamentally wrong. Like, look, this is not some like Bernie. So I'm putting it on its most, like I described it that way because that is actually what's happening. There's a great interview we've played on Breaking Point several times of Newsmax had on a railway guy. And they're like, why are you holding the economy hostage? And he's like, dude, like we don't get sick leave. And the anchor was like, oh yeah, that's kind of messed up. He's like, that's not right. He was like shocked to learn the truth in real time. Anyway, so Marco Rubio yesterday, to his credit, I want to say, he was like, I'm not going to vote for a deal that workers don't accept. He's like, if they don't accept it, I'm not going to ram this down their throat. Not something you would have seen in the year, 2018, in all the right to work stuff. Now, let me try and find his exact tweet because he's still trying to square the difference. It's like, Rubio, just because Congress's authority to pose a heavy-handed solution does not mean that it should. It's wrong for the Biden administration, which has failed to ask Congress to impose a deal that the workers themselves have rejected. Anyway, I think it's, look, it is one person, but John Thune actually said that he's the Senate Majority Whip for the GOP. He said, I don't know if I have the votes to deliver because a lot of Republicans are pissed off that this is happening. That is, that's a shift. I think that's interesting. What do you think of the whole situation? Wait, I just lost you.
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on it just because I haven't followed it too closely. I think the main takeaway is you should not pay sick leave. Like at a basic level.
Shit. Yeah, right?
Right. Like I'm trying to obviously I'm commenting, so it's not that I'm not gonna comment, but it just seems pretty straightforward. Seems there's a variety of ways you could do it. Seems like you could boost wages. Seems like there's a variety of most industries have figured this out, and I suggest that they be encouraged to quote unquote figure it out. Especially when the government is so intertwined, to your point about the 1930s. So look, the key thing is like, this isn't, it's not World War III right now. It's not World War II right now.
That's what I was thinking.
There's a reason why that a lot of the Truman administration got in trouble for trying to basically like enforce World War II era demands on steel workers during the 1940s and the early 1950s. So yeah, that's the immediate takeaway. But no, I want to go back to your point around Hawley and just new economics, because there's an interesting op-ed that Sora Romari wrote. There have been a bunch of these
In the New York Times.
arguments kind of coming from like the new right directions about the GOP needing to be more of a party of workers and, you know, corporate fat cats, all of the obvious arguments you and I have mm-hmm. long been interested in, kind of served as the genesis for our work in, you know, news and politics. That's an interesting case where I think it's important to separate a policy case for something from, okay, but what actually happened? In the sense that if you read Sohrab's article, and I'll link it in the show notes, he's talking about how GOP is too associated with tax cuts, didn't do enough for working class people. I don't know. I just don't see that as being the actual issue that was actually at hand in this election. Mm-hmm. The actual issue in this election, and this is something with which the new right finds itself in awkward tension around, is, hey, like the GOP in a variety of battleground states was clearly deeply out of touch with the electorate. Mm-hmm. Carrie Lake was deeply out of touch with the electorate. Like Lauren Boebert almost lost because she represents a decently moderate district, and she's running like she's in Marjorie Taylor Greene's district. She is so close to losing. You have a guy like Joe Kent in Washington, still hasn't conceded yet. They're doing a recount, but he was a person who should have won that seat, but he clearly wasn't in touch with the district. You know, in Florida, look at Florida. Like, I wouldn't say that Ron DeSantis has been Mr. Reimagining GOP economics for working class base. No, like, he's been focusing, I think, kind of like bigger, more culturally centric, education, COVID, those sorts of issues, but he's in touch with the electorate. That's why he wins by 20 points. So I just don't see any evidence that if Carrie Lake had talked about working class GOP and screw Wall Street, she would have done any better. So that just wasn't the issue at hand. Trump does well with that argument in 2015, 2016, because what, once again, to Noah Smith's point, 2015, 2016 is defined by post-financial crisis anger. That is the debate at hand. Mm-hmm. It's the post-Tea Party moment. It's why is the economic recovery bifurcating so much? In that environment, Donald Trump and Steve Bannon coming out of the gate talking about how Jeb Bush is obsessed with tax cuts for the rich, while at the same time Trump is going to protect Social Security and Medicare, that's a good argument. That's like a central issue. In the same way that Trump saying Jeb Bush was crazy for defending the Iraq war really mattered. But guess what? The war in Iraq, as are tax cuts on the rich, were not up for debate in 2022. And talented politics requires understanding what's actually up for grabs. So once again, like, I think there's an economic case for what the new right post-op is saying, but like actually, and this is why we should close, you know, with our final topic around with social issues, the, you know, gay marriage vote in the House that just passed, out of touchness on sociocultural issues was far bigger. And I actually put like election denial in the sociocultural category.
I agree.
In the sense
you.
That's just like a norms thing.
Yep.
Hey, you lose, you accept it. Mm-hmm. Beyond just like the obvious court cases. But yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on like the gay marriage thing, the social conservatism, and the general like catching before the electorate is.
Yeah, I mean, I think it actually goes hand in hand, which is that you, as I also know, that some of these people who are talking about working class GOP are also, you know, it's funny. Back in the original New Right case, what I would always say is, I was like, it's you people that are out of touch with the cultural values because you're the ones pushing defund the police and all this like elite liberalism, Latinx nonsense on people who don't believe any of that. Now it's flipped though, because now, I mean, I'm not saying that they don't believe that, but at least they're hiding it better. On the right, though, they're taking positions like national abortion bans. You know this. There's a high corollary between being new right and being on for a national abortion ban. Hey, guys, guess what is literally more unpopular than defund the police? National abortion. It takes skill to actually come up with a position which is more unpopular than a national abortion ban. Now, they think, like, they have religious reasons for why they just don't care. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. But like, don't accept that everybody in this country in a secular democracy believes that. And I think people have convincingly
shown
you
very seriously
that they
believe
don't.
In defunding the police for
yeah,
a variety of reasons
right.
too. Like people believe,
be my guess.
I take people at their word when they say what they say.
Yeah, I think that's fine. Okay. So, but again, like, don't presume though that you accept that the entire like country is going to just go along with that. Same on election denial. Like, there's a long, there's a real strategy and thought that they're like, oh, like, you can translate. It is actually deeply elitist. Like, it's one of these things
I know where you're going. I really believe
that you can take Trump's like Dominion energy or Dominion Chinese ballots and be like, no, it's really about like Pennsylvania election law and mail-in ballots. And like, it's just not. And I think, again, I would point to these election results as evidence for that. The most people don't care about mail-in ballots. Now, look, they might have some questions are on the margins around automatically getting a mail-in ballot or not. But like, that's not what you're talking about. Trump literally wants to end all mail-in balloting, which would be a disaster for seniors, which is why I think it's ironic. A lot of seniors are very complicated on this. Now, this is the issue, though, which is that they really believe you can like trick people into thinking that you will take their anger, like what Trump is saying, and then channel it into something legitimate. And the point I've always made from the very beginning, of which I have been ostracized, is like, there is no playing footsie. Like, you're either in or you're out. And I was like, I'm out. I was like, I'm not going to live in an alternative reality where the election was stolen and that a bunch of people who are just being lied to, I'm going to take that and say, yeah, you know what? This is all about Pennsylvania election law, mail-in balloting, and all of this. Because I was like, I knew it was bullshit. And I think that has been vindicated. Because I think people rightfully see, and I think you're right to put election denial in that. It's a political valence of nothing matters and I can do whatever I want based. And that is something, again, I want to say I'm heartened by, that I think most Americans are like, no, you can't. Like, this is crazy. This is also difficult for me because I don't believe in Washington's label on what a moderate is, but people are moderate. It's more about like, what does that mean? They don't like, you know, extremism really on any side. And look, the media will never describe like defund the police and all that other stuff as, or maybe they will today, but they wouldn't at the time, as politically extreme. But like, it clearly was. And I think people can intuit and pick up on these things and are actually very willing to parse it all out for themselves. And also on the gay marriage front, look, I don't know. I have tried to read a little bit into the objections of the GOP senators. A lot of it comes, they couch it all in like religious liberty, Catholic charities, and all this other stuff. I don't know. I genuinely have no idea whether those concerns are true or not. But part of the problem for them is that just most of the country doesn't agree with them at all. And they just want gay marriage to be legal. And they just really don't ever want to talk about it again. And whenever you're on that, you know, on the front of the defense, like, frankly, you've already lost. I also think it's pretty remarkable that the vote went, and it was, I think it was 61-39. I mean, still had 39 GOP senators who voted against it. And, you know, I think that's going to be a problem should you ever choose to run for president. Every single one of those people, Ron DeSantis, at the very least, he's a governor. He doesn't have to deal with it. But for a lot of these people, like, that's a very unpopular vote. And, you know, we'll see. We'll see how it plays out. But I think it's been vindicated of, if you feel extreme, it's just an extreme in the wrong way. You know, Trump was extreme, but he was extreme in the right way in terms of
for the moment specifically.
Right. Specifically for the moment. He was extreme in the way that he was a bulwark against perceived Democratic extremism in 2020. And in 2016, he was expressing the extreme feeling that the establishment genuinely was out of control and something needed to be shaken up. So where is the today's extreme, which is right? I really don't know the answer to that question. If I did, I'd run for president. So
yeah, no, it's funny. Yeah. I really appreciate your point around the debate about the technical objections to the gay marriage statute. Like, there are these there are some people on Twitter who say like, no, like you said, Sagar, this is about like protecting 501c3s right. and churches. But then I see a bunch of like influential conservatives, you know, like Josh Emmer, Ali Beth Stuckey, like just tweeting like, gay marriage is bad.
Yeah.
And
right.
I don't know how to, I mean, there's an obvious answer to this, which is that there's an advantage when you're not having to actually, you know, vote on these issues in Congress, because like it's unclear what the actual answer is. So I think most people are going to default to, okay, non-elected Republicans are just saying the quiet part out loud. And the thing that we'll close on is what I think Noah's most helpful framing on tomorrow's episode is going to be. And quick note, this episode is going to make a bunch of people unhappy. Noah is very acerbic and aggressive. The words stupid are issued quite a lot. Sagar, you know my interview style. I'm not going to invite someone into my podcast home and be like, well, actually, I wouldn't quite use that for two point of language.
Can I just say that to people? Just shut up.
This is our house.
Talk, yeah, exactly.
Say what you want to say. But like that said,
you know, can I tease on that? Because people criticize me for this too. I don't invite somebody on my show just to scream at them. I'm not interested in that.
This isn't debate. This is the key
exactly.
Thing.
It's not debate. We let people talk. If you disagree, that's fine. It's not my job to be your voice. All right. You can think whatever you want. I think he's an interesting guy, or you thought he was an interesting guy. We're going to let him talk. Nobody agrees with anybody 100%. Okay, go ahead.
I'm glad you said that, because I think this is actually just like important to note, because there's been this like interesting profusion. And the way people can have different philosophies for different shows. Mm-hmm. And I think you're in my explicit philosophy. I think it probably comes from like our familial background is that a podcast, a show, Breaking Point, Three Line, whatever, like we've invited someone either into our home or we're going out to lunch with them. And my general approach to those situations is that those situations are just not debate.
Yes.
Debate, which we did in high school, is like a very specific experience. It's also not exactly an experience that I particularly enjoy, especially over Zoom. Like that's the key thing. Like Kyle and I got in a pretty extensive debate about student loans at the Breaking Points live show in Atlanta. I would not have that debate with him over Zoom. Yeah.
Be a nightmare.
It just is not, it's not the same experience. It doesn't work. You have to read a I've known you for freaking 12 years. Mm-hmm. And it's still kind of difficult to like read your expressions over Zoom. So yeah, I want people to just listen to the episode. If he says something you find like uncomfortable and you're mad at me for not like correcting him, that's that. I think fact checking can be a little important. But that's kind of a different kind of point. Is the most valuable thing that I hope people will listen for is his just like defining the rest of the 2020s as just like a period of exhaustion. Mm-hmm. Like America is an exhausted country from all the upheaval and the chaos. And the question you should be answering yourself as either a politician or an actor in a political movement is, what am I doing in the face of that exhaustion? And what I will say, America is not seeking to get into a debate about gay marriage during a point of exhaustion.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
That is the defining reality. And look, if you are a social conservative, if you're on the new right, if you're Josh Hammer, if you're Ali Beth Stuckey, like for a variety of reasons, you can, and I understand why you believe about gay marriage, but you should also understand that you are almost certainly contributing to the out of touchness problem that the GOP ran into. And I think there's a deep lack of comprehension. And this is where like ecosystems and echo chambers come into like at a problematic level. If let me put it this way, if the Trump era, it's actually kind of complicated too, dude, because like Democrats like won the midterms. So it's not even clear that Democrats were punished for this as much. But if an undercurrent of the Trump era and the immediate aftermath of George Floyd's murder was Democrats overreaching on certain questions, pretty clearly 2022 was a year the GOP took that too literally and kind of overreached. And if there's one last thing that I'll close on with like an understanding that Democrats should have about the center left, you know, that's the ideological like household background you and I like come from. So I think I understand people in that space really well. Say what we want about the center left. The center left doesn't make the same mistake twice. By that, I mean, the center left will not campaign in Wisconsin in 2016. Center left shows up in 2020. And by center left, I mean like the Atlantic, Democratic establishment, like the Chuck Schumer. If you come from like that more like technocratic, college, grad school, graduate places, like you learn like very specific like lessons in like very specific ways. So understand that if you're the GOP, Democrats are not going to run on defund again within like this very specific period. Mm-hmm. And folks should understand that.
Yeah, I agree. Part of the problem for the Republicans is they can't do that because Trump is in power and he doesn't learn anything. But
you want to close on Sagar with 2022?
No, I don't think so. We'll see. It's going to be a fun year. I think it'll be, I actually think maybe this is counterintuitive. I think it's going to be a good year. I hope so. I think the economy will get a little bit better. I hope so. I could be totally wrong. I think the economy will get a little bit better. I think some balance has been restored to the force with the midterm elections. There'll be a lot of soul searching going on. I don't predict any major new legislation. And Trump, he's either going to win it or lose it this year. It's not going to be next year. It's going to be this year. He's either going to get indicted this year or not. He's either going to win the primary this year or not. I know that the primaries and all that are in 2024, but I think this is the make or break year. So I think a year from now, when you and I are sitting together, things will actually have a lot more clarity. I think on Ukraine too. I think we'll have a lot more clarity on Ukraine. We'll have a lot more clarity on China. A lot of the uncertainty and shit from this last year, I think we'll be good to go next year.
That is a great place to end, Sagar. Enjoyed speaking with you on this closing year review of the realignment.
All right, we'll see you guys later.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.